delighted to introduce our writer-director, David Ayer, and our cast, which will be Logan Lerman, Michael Pena, and John Bernthal.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Siblings.
Hey. Siblings.
Hey, who's first? Okay, Angela?
Is it Mike?
Sure.
Great job, everybody. Logan, I was going to ask you about your character, because yours goes through this incredible transformation from somebody who's just like a clerk typist to becoming like a diehard soldier in this. And I was just wondering for you, did you feel like you were kind of going through a little bit of a boot camp yourself in terms of being involved with this? Did you guys hang out beforehand? Did you feel like buddies?
Yeah. I would say we had a long training period on this film. David is kind of known for putting his actors through a pretty tough training process. And we had, you know, months where we did, you know, so many different things to, you know, feel comfortable, you know, with this world that we were living in, and then also get to know each other. We had a good solid month where we spent every day, you know, fighting each other in the mornings and learning about the tanks and our positions in the tanks. But most importantly was that, you know, last week where we had a boot camp and we got to know each other very well, and we did become very close in that period of time.
But I just wanted, I remember Logan came in and, you know, like, yeah, we started sparring, and I think there, from my point of view, there's something that changes him. Like, I mean, you know, a couple of times we'd beat him up, you know what I mean? Not gonna lie. And you know, we had gloves on and headgear and all that good stuff. But there's a one point, I don't even know when it happened. Like, you know, you always, you know, you don't try to really beat each other up, but you try to get some good shots, and you can tell when you get hurt or you know you hurt the other person, and he's like, he wanted, you know, he's like, I don't care if I get hurt, he's gonna hit me once really good. And that's a change, that's something that, you know, because we did in the watch together, and there's something that happens when you spar that it really does activate this kind of animalistic instinct that you have, and you know, you really get the bond in a weird way. So you know, I did it with Jake Gyllenhaal, and I did it with these guys. There's something that brings out a lot of honesty in you when you're getting punched in the face.
And it just breaks barriers, you know?
Yeah.
Like, once you feel comfortable punching someone in the face, you can do anything with it.
Yeah, so David Ayer has, like, weird, like, you know, instead of theater moves or whatever it is, like, trust, what is it, trust exercises?
Trust exercises.
Yeah, he's
trust exercises.
Okay, we're going to come right here.
Hey, my question's for John. So, killing zombies or killing Nazis? Where do you? What was better? That's a joke question, but no. What was your mental preparation? What was the mental preparation for some of you guys for just getting into these? You mentioned animalistic for almost getting to that zone.
Since you asked me a joke question, I guess I'll take it. But you know, look at that. To echo what these guys said, I think we were all enormously grateful for the pre-production on this movie. It's not about you know, putting us through hell or anything like that, but this movie mattered so much to our boss, and it mattered so much to all of us, and the level of commitment and the level of investment, you know, 3-4 months before we even started was there, and we were all kind of asked to go outside of our comfort zones, all asked to sort of take steps together that we might have been a little bit afraid to do on our own, but we all pushed each other and kind of got there. And there was we were constantly being tested, constantly being pushed, and I really feel like we became a unit before we walked on set. I'll never forget the first time we came out for our screen test. You know, normally a screen test is sort of a a kind of serious day, but you know, in most movies, but I remember this time it was sort of our day to meet the crew. And I think, and I don't mean this in a weird way, but I think people were genuinely a little bit afraid. You know, we came out there and,
we also smelled.
Yeah. We had really been through it by that point. And, through the boot camp, through the fighting, through the tank training. And honestly, our rehearsals were really more violent than the fighting, to be honest with you. Anything and everything happened there. And, again, I think that, you know, part of David's genius is that he gets you to commit and gets you to take steps and go way beyond your comfort zone. And this thing was like life and death before we started, you know.
My question is Logan. The your character in the Brad Pitt is seems like a brotherhood or more like a fatherhood. I was kind of couldn't decide. So how do you see and on the set, the between the takes? So what's working with Brad Pitt? Could you talk about that?
I mean, yeah, there's definitely a father-son relationship there, and he is. Quickly, you know, in this short period of time in this day, having to educate his, you know, his new recruit, is this, you know, son, you know, on how to survive in wartime. Working with him, though, was great. He was really generous with everything that that he gives. You know, when you're working with him, he gives a lot and asks for very little, and you know, it's incredible to work with him.
Is he a funny guy?
Yeah,
did you get any laughs?
We didn't have many laughs. not a lot of laughs. There wasn't a lot of levity. But no, he is a nice person, though. We definitely worked hard together.
Jamie?
Great. Really enjoyed the film, guys. Congratulations. David, I thought Shia's performance was fantastic. I thought he gave a great performance and much different than what we're used to seeing him do. Could you talk about casting him and sort of casting him against type?
It's I'm trying to remember how he ended up in my kitchen, but he did. And I'm a big believer that there's the right role for the right actor at the right time in their life. And in our conversation, what I got from him, it was a sense of commitment and a willingness to commit and transform and be immersive and really submerge himself into this role and let the role take over his life. And, you know, to that end, I mean, he did a vast amount of prep work. He embedded himself in a National Guard unit. He shadowed a military chaplain so that he could understand how to minister to troops and how scripture related to the soldier's life. He really went deep with it, understood the time period in a great way. But he's a fantastic actor, and there's an incredible rawness to him. And you know, one thing he did, it's easy to showboat as an actor. You get the set and you know, and you want to be seen. And his goal was to disappear into the fabric of the film and feel like the mother of this family and become the emotional center of it and the sort of conscious of the tank and War Daddy's conscious. And he really did a fantastic job at being that.
David. In preparing for this film, both as writer and director, what type of mental preparation did you do to take on such a project and with such talent?
Well, it's interesting. For me, when I'm on set and we're shooting, I tell my director of photography my big joke, and it's not really a joke, because I'm don't think, just do. And for me, it's kind of the same thing, because, you know, as a director, you're a manager. You have this huge amount of resources, this incredible pressure, this timetable. You come up with, you know, a series of complex plans you develop basically with your department heads. You hope it all works out. You hope the tanks don't break down. You hope the weather's favorable. So And obviously, it's a vastly expensive endeavor, and the world's watching. So it's really easiest just to simply put one foot in front of the other and take it day by day, and have a vision and have a goal. So the shorthand answer is don't think.
Joel, if you raise your hand.
Hi, my question is for David. I was just curious about kind of the logistical aspects. I mean, the tanks in this are quite specific to the reality of what happened. I'm curious what kind of help you had, maybe from the military, and also if you kind of consulted with any World War II tank vets to kind of get the authenticity as real as it was.
So, you know, one of the complaints you see in a lot of movies about World War II is that the armor is inaccurate. And it's interesting because the film takes place at the end of the war, so you have this sort of admixture of every iteration of the Sherman tank in the film, which is accurate. And as far as accuracy goes, you could try and build tanks, but it's never going to be correct. You know, there's a lot of guys out there that are fans of the World War II genre, and we call them rivet counters, and they're gonna look up the foundry marks and serial numbers on the turrets and figure out where each tank actually was, because all those records are out there. Every bolt, every detail, is the anti-aircraft gun mount correct? Is that the right shovel in the shovel slot? Is it the post-war version? Is it the 1980 or the 1951 British export version? So people note these details. So that accuracy is important. We worked with several European collectors, and as we started researching the movie, we sort of realized the movie's in Europe, because a lot of this armor and vehicles went out during the Lend-Lease program during World War II, but it's actually illegal to re-import any of it. So this materiel went overseas, stayed overseas, and there it is now in the hands of these collectors. And it's interesting in working with a collector. Can we paint your tank? No. Can we light it on fire? No. So it becomes a challenge, but fortunately we found people who were really game, and they let us paint their tanks and modify them and weld on them and get them absolutely correct to April 1945. And then there's Bruce Crompton, who's a British collector of German military vehicles, and the German equipment is insanely expensive and incredibly rare. So there's vehicles that simply haven't been in the movie before, like the Tiger I that's in the film, which we sourced from Bombing the Tank Museum, was captured by the British people, British military, in 1943. It's a famous vehicle, and we were very fortunate to get it. There's never been a real Tiger in a movie.
Jared, right here.
Guys, congratulations on this. Just a fantastic job from all of you. David, I'm wondering what you might pinpoint as the toughest day of filming. And Logan, considering that Norman comes into this with no knowledge of you know what he's getting himself into, what would you pinpoint as the thing that maybe was the most difficult for you to wrap your head around with the character?
So as far as the toughest day of filming, it's interesting. One would think that standing in the mud at 3 a.m. with you know, the rain and pyro and explosions and tanks and all sorts of things like that happening would be the toughest day. That's actually where I'm at my happiest. The toughest day for me was the dinner scene that we shot in the apartment. Nobody came out of there intact, let's just say. And it was bare-knuckled acting, and it's the kind of thing where the next day you kind of shuffle over the actors and kind of look in your feet and, hey, are we still buddies? Still don't know the answer to that.
I would say the toughest aspect, I guess, to working on this film and figuring out, you know, how to portray Norman was, I guess, mapping his arc and his change from afraid to kill to killer. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things that happen to him in this, you know, this day that this movie takes place in, and to make it realistic and kind of try to have a gradual change and, you know, pick the right moments was probably the most difficult aspect to portraying Norman.
Right there in the front.
Okay, good morning, David, over here. Congrats again on making such another intensive, engaging movie. Now, I recall it was just, what, 8 years ago when you took a huge financial risk with, what was it, Harsh Times?
Harsh.
And if I'm correct, you remortgaged your home to actually make this movie. So now, looking back, especially now things have, you know, obviously progressed for you, was that the best risk you've ever made in your career?
Rule number one in Hollywood is don't make a movie with your own money. I'm going to follow that rule in the future, and it's going to make my wife happy that I do that. It's still terrifying. It's still terrifying to think about that and that risk that I took. But I'm not a film school grad. I'm sort of a wrong side of the tracks guy. No one was going to hand me a directing opportunity unless I created it for myself.
Right there.
Hi. So we've seen plenty of World War II movies, but this one was really a standout. Everybody was great, the tank warfare, and especially having a Latino in the lead, which we've never seen. As far as research, what did you do? What did you research as far as Latinos in the military and that kind of stuff?
It was actually way harder than I thought it was going to be honest with you. I'm like, it's good to have a buddy that writes, he's written a Latino in every movie that he's had. Which I, End of Watch was an amazing role, and I had to read it 3 times to make sure that I did have that part. But there's not a lot in, like, Wikipedia. There's not a lot in just standalone newspaper clippings, and it was shocking, to be honest with you, because there was about, like, 500,000 Latinos that actually fought in World War II. And so we just started creating a character, really, and, estimating what it would be like, so we made him a zoot suiter, so that's why he was wearing the chain outside, and, I had a lot of help on this one, because every time he would give me direction, he would speak to me in Spanish, and for the cadence, because there's not a lot of, that way of talking in any other movie or in videos that I saw, so, I started watching some of the older movies, and if you guys remember, there's like a little, like a top hat thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Gordo probably watches all these movies and thinks that they're really cool, And so I try to put in a lot of stuff that I think would be cool, like in, 30s and 40s movies. But I think the biggest one is just us talking about this guy, how it was tough at home because it seemed like nobody really liked him at home. And then here he is getting shot by, Nazis. So there was a level of depression that we... that I try to deal with, with drinking in the film. That's the way he was coping, and it's hard to imagine somebody being hated on both sides. Mm-hmm. And so that's what that was my crutch in the movie.
There's some funny stuff in there that you're doing some Spanish. Was that ad libbed or was that in the script? It was hilarious.
That's like David going, "Hey, say this shit, dude." I'm not kidding. No, but it would be funny.
But it's a little bit sad that Latinos made a huge contribution to the war effort in World War II, and not just in uniform. Between 250,000 to 500,000 served, and there's no records, so it's hard to say. And then obviously in the home front, as the white boys went to fight, they had to fill these jobs in the factories. And it was really the first period of sort of franchisement for the Latino community in America, because they had jobs, they had money, and they're fighting for their country and their freedom. And what people don't realize is there's 17 Hispanic Medal of Honor winners in World War II that won our nation's highest honor. I mean, incredible contribution. And as I looked at the period photographs of these tank crews, you start to see more and more Latinos. And I'd show Mike, and I'd go, "Hey, look at this guy," And you start to see it once you look for it. You realize, like, how prevalent and how present they were in the war. But unfortunately, in a lot of these films, they just haven't shown that aspect. They haven't shown that diversity.
But also what was interesting is to be written, sorry, just to, like, I did End of Watch, was a completely different character. And so I remember reading it and being like, oh, man, this is, like, I was really excited. I'm like, thanks for writing me the part. And then I was like, shit. It just seemed like a very difficult part to do, because he wasn't like a, me, John Bernthal, and Shia, we would get together and say, like, Logan's got a storyline, Brad's got a storyline, us three got to form like Voltron, in a way, And then Shia, like, "You're the head, I'm the whole, wait, let's figure this out," Like, I know, but I mean, literally, like, months and months of that, And then it was really cool that, you know, you're right, like, it wasn't like anything I've seen of Shia. Like, he really didn't care if shining or not. You know, we basically kind of made a pact. I'm like, you know, you're as strong as I am, and I'm as strong as you are, and he's strong, you know, and try to form that triangle and try to be the scenes. And you really, you know, help the scenery for the movie, you know, and paint the picture of war.
Right over here on the end.
Hi. This question is for Michael. I really did like the Gordo name, which really wasn't explained. Loved it. But considering your contribution to the Latino community, are you interested in or have plans for doing a Spanish or Mexican film production, working with like directors like Guillermo del Toro?
Oh yeah, I mean I worked with Alejandro Iñárritu. I did work with him, but I work with Gila Luna, and I'd like to keep on working with those guys. And the one thing that I remember growing up and having people change their names and turn their back on Latin roles, and I just decided a long time ago that I was never going to do that, that I wanted to do something for my people and be inspired just like Edward James Olmos did in Stand and Deliver. And I actually ended up doing Calculus in high school because it was just such a strong image in my head that's what I wanted to do. But I'd love to do movies in Spanish. I'm like, I'd have to get better at Spanish, but I'm not too bad. But he can tell you how the name of Gordo came about.
There was a comic strip that came out in 1941 called Gordo, and it was one of the actual first positive depiction of Latinos in U.S. media. And the author of the strip, I don't recall his name, but actually ended up serving in World War II. But because of that comic strip, it was sort of common for Latinos to be given that nickname, Gordo.
Brad's obviously one of the more famous movie actors, somebody that people think they know a lot about. I'm curious, during that early bonding period you guys got to have, what was sort of the intriguing, unexpected, or fun things you learned about Brad throughout that process?
What did you learn, John?
Yeah. look, you know, I'll be honest with you, man. I can't say enough good about Brad. And I understand a lot of people kiss his ass, and I guess if we're here, I just have to kiss it. But I felt like he was completely not only willing but eager and desperate to dive in every inch as far as the rest of us. And at no point did he try to sort of separate himself or hold himself on a pedestal. I respected him immediately for that, and it seemed to me that, you know, the colder it got and the wetter it got or the tougher it got, the bigger the smile on his face was. And you know, look, I don't know what it's like to be a big movie star and all, but I would imagine that he enjoyed the fact that David in no way let him get away with anything. And he was one of the guys and had every bit as much responsibility to dive in, again, as much as we did. And that goes for the boot camp, that goes for the fighting, that goes for the tank training. And he wanted that. He craved that. And I just, you know, any time the chips got down at all, you know, in boot camp or whatever, I'm not going to lie to you, it's kind of cool just kind of looking over and be like, man, Brad Pitt, dude, he's doing this shit. I better do it too. You know what I mean? And there's something to that. And, yeah, I just... He's a lovely guy, and he's a family man, and I'm proud to call him a friend.
Right here. Hi. Going back to the dinner scene, that scene was one that really stood out to me in terms of when all the guys are at the table, there's like a hostility going on, but as the scene goes on, it changes to where it's like the men sort of regain their humanity, and it reminded me of the end scene of Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory, of how all these soldiers are laughing at this German woman on stage, and then she starts to sing and they start to cry. And I was just curious, how did that scene come about, and for the actors, what was it like acting that scene?
How did that scene come about? That's a really good question. I did a lot of primary source research, and you realize that it's a workaday world for these guys. This sort of, it's sort of a blue collar existence for these tank crews at this point in the war, and it's go capture the town, go get this town, take this hill, take this ridge, capture that road junction. You know, you're given a laundry list of tasks, and you know we think about all these famous battles and these war winning battles, but I liken these guys to coal miners. You know, they put on their safety gear and they go in and they do their work and they come out at the end of the day. And a common pattern was they would capture a town and by early afternoon they'd be in control of it and they'd start kicking in cellar doors and looking for wine and looking for food and they'd make, you know, the locals would cook for them and they'd do what guys do and pass out and get up the next day and roll out at 4 a.m. and take the next town. And there's something interesting about that, the idea of you're in this war zone and then you go into a house and there's civilization and there's humanity and there's people in there. And in these movies, there's always a very sort of one-sided depiction of either side. And what happens when these people are together in this living room. And I imagine the scene is sort of the ultimate Thanksgiving dinner. And I think we've all had those sort of bad family dinners ourselves. And the idea is that this crew's a family. And a family can be love-hate. And no one can wound you like a family member. No one can hurt you like your brother or sister who just says that one thing and spins you. And that was what all the training and the boot camp and the rehearsal and the familiarity was leading up to for me, was really that scene, to get these guys as close as brothers so that they could go at each other like only brothers can.
Michael?
David, like a lot of us, I've had the luxury of not having to witness tank fire in real life. And I had noticed that in the film, it almost looks like lasers, and the Nazi fire is green, the American fire is red. I was wondering if that was a stylistic choice just for us to be able to decipher it more easily, or if it was actually based on something.
No, in even present day, but in World War II, the machine gun rounds, every few rounds would have a phosphorus base, a tracer base, and it burns at something like 6,000 Kelvin. I mean, it burns as hot as the sun. They're incredibly bright. And the U.S. tracers were typically red or pink. German tracers were often orange, but mostly green for the small arms. And the Japanese tracers were either purple or blue. So each side had a specific color code to their tracers. So if they're all the same color, you see tracers, you light up that position because they work both ways. You know, it could be friendly fire. We wanted to sort of break lengths to accurately portray that. Rate of fire, muzzle velocity, distance traveled. MG-42 fires 1,200 rounds a minute over 800 yards, so you can sort of reverse engineer at a 1/48th frame exposure for film the actual distance that you would see each tracer streak and then compute that, run it through a computer, and then sort of depict it on screen. So we went through sort of great pains to kind of accurately portray that. We had a lot of World War II footage that showed tracers, and we actually sent a film crew to a military base, loaded up some machine guns with two World War II spec, fired them, and then used that as our references. And it's incredibly beautiful when you see it in person. I mean, it's fantastic. My military buddies that have seen it, they're like, yeah, it's bang on.
Rudy?
As the movie's really intense, at least for me as the viewer, it was intense. It just seems strong and emotional. So with that said, what was the most intense line that you delivered as actors that made you be like, you were ready for it to be over with, and you were done, and you needed to take a break, and you're just glad it's over with? What was that intense line?
Mine was
line?
A monologue. That monologue that the... for the dinner scene, I think that was the toughest one for me. I remember we started shooting, and then I was like an emotional mess. And then David's like, "Hey, let me shoot the other guys first, so you can get warmed up." And I was like, "Dude, I don't need any. I've been doing this for 5 months, buddy. Let's just go right now." Everyone's had like big scenes, you know what I mean? And we would all be very. And we would know, you know, when the next scene was coming up, or when somebody's big scene were coming, and we would try to be as supportive as possible. And I remember these guys, you know, Berndahl and Shia were like, we shot it in like a day and a half or something like that. I don't even remember. But they were always there and, you know what I mean, tearing up at every take, really supporting me because it was almost like us against them in a way. You know, here comes this, you know, like our big brother is playing favorites to this guy. And we all took it very seriously. And so when I tell the story about the horses, which he never once repeated, you know, these guys are like, you know, gave me the green light, so to speak. And they were there emotionally as well. So that was the toughest.
You know, I think, you know, like Mikey said, that we all had those scenes that we sort of circled on the calendar. Like, you know, we could pretty much count down to the hour of, you know, when we were going to get to those scenes. But, you know, sort of what we were talking about before, about family and going for the jugular, you know, for me, I felt like looking back on it, it wasn't about those scenes, but it was that at any moment, everyone here and Shy and Brad and the boss were armed with this information that could cut you down, that could break you. And because we were so familiar, because we were so close with each other, and David, you know, the way he kind of orchestrates the thing is he'll set people loose on people, put the camera in somebody's face, and then just rip them apart. And sometimes it's something that another actor says. Sometimes it's something that he comes up and whispers in your ear. I mean, I'll be honest with you, after just even a month in of shooting, when I saw him sort of walking towards me, I started to shake and sweat because I knew what was coming in my ear was going to break me. And even though you know what he's trying to do, and it's result, you know, it's for a result, you know, it scares me now, honestly, thinking about it. And so the thing that, you know, those kinds of things that you never knew, and also to do that to one of these guys that you love so much, to see them, and then you get the word, like, go after that dude, go get him, you know, and like David said, it's family. So, you know, I know what to say to you, and it's this, and then it becomes this kind of like perverse, beautiful game. Not a game, but you know that we're trying to cut each other down. We're trying to break each other, and that's what family does. And look, it was uniform among every tank veteran we talked to. You don't pick your family, you don't pick your tank crew. These guys are as close as units can possibly get. And you know that's what we were going for, and that familiarity and that that bond, it's just as dangerous as it is lovely, you know.
Right there.
This question is for Michael and John. Michael, you had talked about kind of crafting the story behind your characters, especially the two of you and Shia. Could you talk a little bit more about that, the both of you, and particularly like your mental and psychological responses to kind of the chaos that your character faced?
Oh yeah, it was a little bit different for us because we were together for three years, and I think what we talked about a lot is you know, we start off with one of our best friends dying, Red, and how much that affected us and how much of a dysfunctional family we were. To me, I'm like a lot of it was already set by the way I spoke and by the way I dressed. And it was cool that it was hardly ever talked about, really, but that I just had a Latin guy in the tank. And that's a, you know, best way to tell any social commentary is just to let it happen.